President Zeron reiterates that all sanctions against it must be lifted in a verifiable manner in the run-up to the upcoming Vienna talks. Anger boils in Jordan over the normalization of ties with Israel, with thousands protesting a water for energy deal their country has newly signed with Israel. And also, Palestinians hold a funeral for a 14-year-old boy who was shot dead by Israeli soldiers in the occupied West Bank. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iran says the upcoming Vienna talks with the remaining parties to the 2015 nuclear deal, or the JCPOA, can yield a good and even immediate agreement. The Iranian foreign minister made the remarks in a phone call with the European Union's foreign policy chief, Hossein Ami Abdullahi, however, stressed that any agreement requires a readiness on the other side to fully return to its commitments and remove sanctions on Iran in a verifiable manner. He said despite the violation of the JCPOA by the U.S. and the European signatories, Iran attends the talks in good faith and with seriousness. He called for sufficient and strict guarantees that the U.S. would not abandon the agreement again. For his part, Josep Borrell said, the only way for the removal of sanctions on Iran is the revival of the nuclear deal. Well, the fate of the Iran nuclear deal under the spotlight as the Austrian capital, Vienna, prepares to host a new round of talks among the remaining signatories to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. In the following report, we will tell you how the hard-earned achievement of international diplomacy has unraveled over the past years.
On life support, in tatters, and on the verge of collapse. These are some of the terms that have been used to describe the current status of the hard-earned nuclear deal that emerged in 2015 after so many rounds of painstaking diplomacy between Iran and the P5+1 group of countries. The deal is almost dead, with the U.S. having abandoned it, the European parties failing to abide by their commitments or make up for the damage from the U.S. withdrawal, and Iran having rolled back some of its commitments. Who's to blame for the status quo? Many point the finger at former American President Donald Trump and his favorite maximum pressure policy involving a long list of anti-Iran sanctions. His successor, Joe Biden, a vociferous critic of Trump's confrontational approach, has insisted that he wants to return to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. But after taking office in January, his administration has enforced every single sanction that the former president imposed against the Iranians. This has led Iran to doubt Biden's seriousness. Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, held six rounds of talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna, between April and June to find a path back into compliance with the deal. But critics say the Biden administration missed that window of opportunity by refusing to make up for America's unilateral withdrawal and provide proper assurances that it will not violate the deal again. Despite this, the involved parties are going to give diplomacy another chance with a new round of talks scheduled to take place later this month.
Iran and the P4+1 are preparing for a new round of talks, with Tehran insisting that the negotiations must lead to the removal of sanctions. Observers are wondering how the United States and its European allies are going to build confidence after many years of violations of their promises. This next report and try to find out.
Discussions are set to resume in Vienna next week. Top negotiators from Iran, Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany will sit down for talks again. U.S. representatives will also be in the city, but not in the same room, as Iranians won't directly talk to the party that unilaterally withdrew from the international deal. What are the talks' chances of success? Iran says to be successful, the dialogue must lead to the removal of sanctions. Tehran also insists that America must offer guarantees that it will not abandon the deal again. The U.S. has repeatedly rejected Iranian demands for such guarantees. How is the U.S. planning to deal with its seriously damaged credibility? The head of Iran's permanent mission to the international organizations in Vienna said this week that the United States should prove its goodwill by removing sanctions against Iran. During a meeting of the International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors, he said that the credible and effective lifting of sanctions is the basis of Iran's willingness to abide by the terms of the agreement. He said it is unfortunate that European countries still do not want to openly condemn the unilateral withdrawal of the United States and the reimposition of sanctions, which is the only cause of all current problems.
First of all, in order to understand Europe, you have to understand the European Union. To understand the European Union, you have to understand it is under the control of Germany. Germany is a vassal state of the United States of America. Germany was conquered after World War II, where they lost the war, and they have been a vassal state ever since that time. The vassal does not tell the sovereign what to do. That's why they're not arguing with the United States. The United States tells them what to do, not the other way around.
It is definitely hard to guess what direction the talks will take, but the next meeting could shed light on how the two sides will approach the discussions.
Moving on, anger in Jordan over the normalization of ties with Israel. Thousands have hit the streets in Amman to protest a recent cooperation deal between Jordan and Israel on energy and water. Protesters condemn the deal as humiliating. They say normalization of ties with Tel Aviv is a betrayal of the Palestinian cause. Under the U.S. brokered deal, Jordan will provide solar power to Israel in exchange for desalinated water. The United Arab Emirates, which hosted the signing ceremony on Monday, will reportedly build a solar power plant in Jordan. The UAE was among several Arab countries that signed a normalization deal with Israel in September 2020, despite widespread opposition from the Muslim world. Elsewhere, hundreds of Palestinians attend the funeral of a teenager shot dead by Israeli soldiers last month in the occupied West Bank. Mourners in Bethlehem chanted anti-Israeli slogans as they said farewell to the victim. They called for justice for 14-year-old Amjad Abu Sultan, who was killed in the city in mid-October. His body was seized by Israeli forces and was not released to his family until late Saturday. Autopsy results show Amjad was shot 3 times at close range. Leaders of different political parties in Pakistan have held a conference in the southern port city of Karachi to condemn the UK's declaration of the Palestinian movement of Hamas as a terrorist organization, Mohammed Turi reports.
The Zal Party's conference is convened here in the commercial hub of Pakistan to condemn the UK's move of declaring Hamas a terrorist organization.
Participants of the conference stress on the need for unity among Muslims and called on the international community to take serious notice of what they call the unilateral action of the old colonial power, the UK, who gave birth to the Zionist regime in the heart of Muslim world.
The conference was organized by Palestine Foundation of Pakistan, aiming to launch further series of week-long activities across the country.
We are all very much disturbed because of the United Nations and the United States policies about the Palestine and about the Israel. Israel is killing Muslims in all over the Palestine, and they are burning the houses and the colonies of the Muslim and building up the colonies for the Jews.
It's a clear nonsense because, you know, the Hamas is the only representative of the Palestinian. All the organizations, they represented by the peoples, they do not involve in terrorism. The UK and Australian have their own terrorist organization, which was supported by UK. Our terrorists from Karachi is in UK, and they were giving the shelter to them. So this is a nonsense, and we do not accept that. and we condemned it.
The UK's move in November coincided with Balfour Declaration in 1917, when British colonial imperialist power created the Zionist apartheid.
Actually, Israel is defeating. Israel will be no more in the map of world in nearby future. So that's why their creator, especially British government and United States administration, they are worried.
Participants called on the Prime Minister Imran Khan to do more than mere condemnation of the UK's government, that instead of apologizing and correcting its historical wrongs across the world and against the Palestinian people, is supporting the aggressor both in Kashmir and Palestine. Mohammed Touri, Karachi.
We're going to go back to one of our previous stories now, where anger in Jordan over the normalization of ties with Israel is boiling over. Thousands have hit the streets in Amman to protest a recent cooperation deal between Jordan and Israel on energy and water. Writer and political analyst Said Shabi joins us now from the British capital, London. Let's hit the ground running with you, Mr. Shahabi, and give us your thoughts on this recent deal.
Thank you very much. This is a very disturbing news, although we are used to having news from Jordan that they were contacting Israel and establishing links with them. Unfortunately, this time it is the United Arab Emirates that is pushing Jordan to reach this agreement with Israel, by which Jordan is going to create energy, what they call green energy, to give it to Israel. And in return, they will get some water from the desalination plants from the occupiers. Now, the UAE, the Emirates, is paying for the whole process. It's paying for to build the energy supply, the generation of electricity generation in Jordan using these new technologies, solar panels and so on. It just to ensure that Jordan goes into more practical relations with Israel. Like now, Morocco also is going to import more arsenal and more weapons and from Israel. It is the UAE that is pushing all these countries to establish links, practical links, and to enter into more agreements with the with the Israelis. I just don't understand why the UAE has placed itself as the foreign ministry of Israel, which it goes to African countries, to Arab countries, in order to encourage them to normalize relations with the occupiers of Palestine. This is one of the worst scenarios and worst situations that I have ever come across in the past 50, 70 years after the creation of Israel. So this is a very, very tragic situation in which Jordan is binding itself with long-term agreements with the occupiers, while the Palestinians are killed almost every day. There is rarely a day that passes without a Palestinian being killed by the Israelis. This is a very disturbing situation, and this is why the people of Jordan today went to the streets in protest against this. The Jordanians, most Arab people and Muslim people, do not want to go that far without Israel withdrawing from the Palestinian land.
Writer and political analyst Said Shabi joining us from the British capital, London. Thank you for your comments, sir. Yemen's prime minister has paid honor to Press TV for its major role in supporting the impoverished nation of Yemen since the beginning of the Saudi-led war on the country in March 2015. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif Al-Washami, has more in this following report.
In an event in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, Yemen's Prime Minister Abdulaziz bin Habtour honored the Press TV for its prominent role in standing by the Yemeni people and exposing the crimes of the Saudi-led coalition since the beginning of the war.
I would like to thank Press TV and its crew for standing by the Yemeni people in the face of the war imposed on us.
Press TV reveals the truth about the war that has taken place between the Axis of Resistance and the U.S. proxies in the region. Sana'a is just one of the front lines of this confrontation. We greatly appreciate every effort made by satellite channels that honestly expose the crimes of the Saudi-led coalition and reveal the suffering of Yemenis to the world amid the continuing war and siege imposed by Saudi Arabia.
Participants said the Press TV has always been supporting the Yemeni people and its major role is clear through its continuing existence in the field to keep pace with the advancements of the Yemeni army and the Saudi violations against Yemenis.
Press TV is one of the leading channels that serves as a role model for free media and contributes to the resistance of the Yemeni people. This channel has had a prominent impact on Yemenis by keeping pace with every event, whether the victories of the Yemeni army or the crimes of the Saudi-led coalition. So Press TV deserves to be honored and appreciated by the Prime Minister.
Since the beginning of 2015, Yemenis have been suffering under war and siege imposed by Saudi Arabia. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis and says millions of Yemenis, including children, are on the brink of famine.
Observers say Saudi Arabia has used thousands of media outlets to spread its propaganda and mislead the free people of the world about its war crimes in Yemen. Therefore, as observers say, the resistance media outlets should stand together against the Saudi-led coalition media war. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
With the detection of a new COVID-19 variant, European countries are taking extra measures to prevent the spread of the new strain. Belgium on Friday detected Europe's first confirmed case of the new variant as it announced measures to contain a fourth wave of the pandemic. Meanwhile, the European Union urged all member states to stop all flights to and from southern Africa following the discovery of the new COVID strain there. In the Netherlands, authorities recorded 20,000 daily new cases for the past week. The country plans to tighten coronavirus restrictions to curb the rise. Germany and Portugal are also returning some measures, such as mask mandates and travel restrictions to battle the current wave of the pandemic. And Iran continues to tighten the noose around the coronavirus pandemic as it records the fewest daily deaths in almost 8 months. The country has reported 86 more fatalities and nearly 4,400 new cases. Also, for the first time in nearly 10 months, no cities in the country are classified as red or very high risk zones. The country has emerged from the fifth wave of the pandemic with a decline attributed mainly to the vaccination drive. Over 104 million jabs have been administered so far. More than 57 million people have been fully vaccinated, while nearly a million have received booster shots. Since the beginning of the pandemic, Iran has recorded over 6.1 million infections, with nearly 130,000 proving to be fatal. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
the limelight.
In Britain, delays to the vaccination rollout mean some 12 to 15-year-olds may not get their COVID jab until February of next year, 15 weeks after the government's original target for offering the jab to all eligible teenagers, according to the Labour Party. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Sally Wheel and Dennis Campbell. The piece is titled, COVID jab wait for 12 to 15-year-olds in England could be up to 5 months. Britain, delays to the vaccination rollout mean that some 12 to 15-year-olds may not get their COVID jab until February of next year, 15 weeks after the government's original target for offering the jab to all eligible teenagers, according to the Labour Party. Officials originally set October half-term as a target to invite those in the age group to receive the vaccine in schools, after criticism that England was slow to approve it for children compared to other countries. New analysis by the Labour Party suggests, however, that if the vaccination of the 2.8 million eligible 12 to 15-year-olds continues at the current rate, it could take until 7th of February next year for some teenagers to be jabbed, a five-month wait for some. Vaccination began in schools in September, but with high infection numbers and low vaccination rates, a growing number of walk-in vaccine sites have since been made available to speed up the process. According to the new analysis, over a four-week period, up to 15th of November, an average of just over 147,000 school pupils got the jab each week. Latest reported figures show that almost 60% of children are still unvaccinated, while 42.1%, almost 1,127,000 of them, have been vaccinated. Labour has called on the government to make better use of community pharmacies and pop-up clinics, as well as bring back volunteers and retired clinicians to expand capacity and speed up vaccinations of 12 to 15-year-olds. The Shadow Education Secretary, Kate Green, said, "Children have been treated as an afterthought throughout this pandemic and continue to be let down by a Conservative government which has shown no care for them and their futures." Paul Whiteman, General Secretary of the National Association of Head Teachers, said, "We don't know yet what the final take-up of the vaccine will be for teenagers. It may never be as high as in the general population. So it is important that other measures are also pursued to control COVID in schools, including help to improve key mitigation, such as better ventilation in classrooms, reconsidering the current guidance on close contact isolation, and an effective track and trace system to ensure cases are identified early." The Department of Health and Social Care spokesperson said, "Our vaccination program continues to be a phenomenal success, and children can get vaccinated at school or use the national booking system. Already, over 40% of 12 to 15-year-olds have been vaccinated. Vaccines save lives, and we're doing everything we can to keep encouraging more people to come forward. Our booster program has made huge progress, with over 15 million doses of the vaccine administered so far across the United Kingdom." Walk-in vaccine clinics for 12 to 15-year-old teenagers are expected to be launched in England within weeks, to stem rising rates of COVID-19 infections within secondary schools. The news came as the United Kingdom recorded 45,140 new COVID cases, the highest daily number since middle of July, and 57 new deaths within 28 days of a positive test. The percentage of Britons testing positive for coronavirus is currently highest for those aged between 12 and 15. Yet the vaccination rate among this age group stands at just 14.2% in England, compared to 44.3% in Scotland, prompting criticism about England's decision to administer vaccinations solely through schools. Older teenagers in England can already attend walk-in clinics to receive their first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, with 56.5% of 16 to 18-year-olds now vaccinated. The expansion of the scheme to younger teenagers would bring England into line with Scotland, where 12 to 15-year-old teenagers can also attend walk-in clinics. In Wales, 12 to 15-year-olds are largely being vaccinated at vaccination centres, while in Northern Ireland, like England, the rollout is largely being conducted within schools. Ministers are also planning to expand walk-in vaccination appointments to younger teenagers amid concern that the government has been too slow rolling out the vaccine programme in English schools.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
brutal brutes.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and in this episode, we'll speak about police brutality, which has become synonymous with police action in the U.S. Every single year, more than 1,000 Americans die at the hands of police, and the numbers only seem to be rising. This week, we have two distinguished guests on our program, Gerald Horn, who is a professor of African American Studies at the University of Houston, and Life Malcolm, who is a community organizer. Please stay with us.
Statistics show that the trend of fatal police shootings in the U.S. seems to only be increasing, with a total of 716 civilians having been shot, 111 of whom were black, as of October 2021. In 2020, there were 1,021 fatal police shootings, and in 2019, there were 999. Additionally, the rate of fatal police shootings among black Americans was much higher than that for any other ethnicity, standing at 37 fatal shootings per million of the population as of October 2021.
And now, based on research published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States of America, police violence is a leading cause of death for young men in the U.S. Over a life course, about one in every 1,000 black men can expect to be killed by police. Professor Horn explains the state of police brutality in America a year after the murder of George Floyd.
You may recall that after the killing of George Floyd at the hands of the Minneapolis Police Department in the late spring of 2020, there were massive demonstrations, not only in the United States, but around the world, because of the police terror inflicted upon black people. By some measures, these represented the largest demonstrations in the history of the United States of America. And as a result, we expected serious change to ensue. But that change has not come as of yet. In fact, there has been a backlash against change. You may have seen the results of the elections that took place in the United States on the first Tuesday of November of 2021. And you may also have noticed that many politicians were elected who are opposed to any change in police practices. This suggests that going forward, the road will be rocky indeed.
Black men are about 2.5 times more likely to be killed by police than are white men. Black people who are fatally shot by police seem to be twice as likely as white people to be unarmed. Latino, American Indian, and Alaskan Native men and women are also significantly more likely to be killed by police than their white counterparts. Mr. Malcolm tells us if anything has improved more than a year after George Floyd's death.
No, nothing has improved regarding police brutality in the U.S. since George Floyd. It's likely worsened, if there is such a thing. It's always been extreme violence and extreme terror at the hands of police when it comes to African people and other colonized people in the U.S. The George Floyd murder happened to be one of the most brutal instances of police violence captured on video, maybe since the Rodney King beating in the early 1990s in this country. And so everybody had an opportunity to, you know, when I say everybody, I mean people all around the world had the opportunity to witness the extreme violence and police terror that police heap upon the heads of ordinary Africans in this country every day.
Information from more than 2 million 911 calls in two U.S. cities reveals that white officers dispatched to black neighborhoods fired their guns 5 times more than black officers dispatched for similar calls to the same neighborhood. So what is the role of race when it comes to police violence?
In the United States, overwhelmingly and disproportionately, the victims of police terror happen to be black. Many of us see this as the legacy of slavery. You know that in the United States and North America, there has been enslavement of African people longer than there has been freedom for African people. Enslavement of African people for 300 years or more, freedom, quote unquote, for a period since 1865.
In many states, a Bill of Rights for law enforcement officers shields personnel from investigation into misconduct. Even officers who are fired for misconduct are frequently rehired. The New York Times reported in 2015 that the police officer in Cleveland, Ohio, who fatally shot 12-year-old Tamir Rice in 2014, had previously resigned from another police department after it had deemed him unfit to serve. The Cleveland police did not review the officer's personnel file before hiring him.
We're intelligent people who are colonized, don't fight and struggle against racism. We all who are colonized in this world by white people, the role that racism plays in police brutality is to distract colonized people from the real struggle, which is that against colonialism, the fight for power, the fight for land, the fight for territory, the fight for freedom.
After many incidents in which police used brute force against unarmed African Americans, it seemed that people were fed up once they watched exactly how police officer Derek Chauvin planted a knee on the back of the neck of George Floyd for over 9.5 minutes and killed him, all the while he pleaded that he cannot breathe. The question one might ask is that are American police more violent in general?
I think that the figures show that the United States is one of the most violent nations on planet Earth. I see this as a legacy of how the nation was created. It was created by a violent seizure of the land from the indigenous population, a liquidation of a good deal of the indigenous population, and then kidnapping Africans with violence and bringing them to these shores to work for free for hundreds of years. That led to slave revolts that were repressed with bloodshed. And this is the culture that has been bequeathed to us today.
Thousands started protests and riots across America and later all around the world against police violence. The protesters demanded the defunding of the police, prosecution of the officers involved, and a dramatic change in law enforcement procedure, law, police recruitment, and to dismantle the systems of mass criminalization and incarceration. In light of these protests, what has the U.S. government done to decrease police violence?
The only thing that the American government, the United States government, has done for police brutality is give the brutal police more money. Almost in every city and every state in this country, each year, the police budget increases. The numbers, the headcount on the police force increases. And of course, the brutality of the police increase. So if the United States government has done anything to that affects police brutality, is give them more money for more guns and more terroristic tactics.
This is why, according to a report published in 2020, police budgets continue to be consistent across diverse geographies and cities in America, with up to 20% to 45% of discretionary funds allocated to the violent system.
After Reconstruction, the slave patrols morphed into local police departments determined to enforce Jim Crow laws to control black people. Police unions really began consolidating power in the 1950s in response to activists pushing for police reform. Fighting against oversight and advocating fiercely for their own ranks, they developed strict rules that remain in place for most police forces today. Police power continued to expand after the 1960s civil rights movement. The 1965 Law Enforcement Assistance Act, part of President Johnson's administration's war on crime, paved the way for militarization and funding by increasing federal involvement in local policing through grants. The support for local law enforcement from the federal government continued to grow, with a series of laws passed under subsequent presidents, from Reagan to Trump, that further aligned police departments with the military and perpetuated funding.
Center for Popular Democracy Action released newly updated data from their 2017 Freedom to Thrive report. The updated data exemplified much of what is already known to be true. The police continue to receive an astronomical percentage of discretionary funds compared to resources that actually keep communities safe. All of the police budgets analyzed in the report have increased since 2017.
Certainly, under Mr. Trump, the police were out of control. The U.S. Justice Department, which has central authority over the so-called criminal justice system, basically went asleep under Mr. Trump between 2016 and his defeat in 2020.
Also, police reform movements largely failed on ballots across the nation, but one Black Lives Matter activist running on a defund the police platform won a seat and became the youngest member of the Des Moines, Iowa City Council.
The Black Lives Matter movement has given so-called officials an out, an escape. It allows these so-called officials to appear to be friends of African and other colonized people in the U.S., by adopting this pop slogan, you know. But the reality is Joseph Robinette Biden, who is the same white man who put 100,000 or so police on the street that do the brutality to African people you and I are discussing right now all the time. That same Joseph Robinette Biden who is the puppet master of the police can say Black Lives Matter. Some police will say Black Lives Matter and at the same time shoot Black lives down.
In Minneapolis, where Floyd was killed by a police officer last year, voters rejected a citywide ballot measure, also known as Question 2, to overhaul the city's police department by replacing it with a new agency that would take a public health approach to law enforcement. Five council members who backed the initiative were ousted from their seat. And in Seattle, a city that saw extended protests in the wake of Floyd's death, Republican Ann Davison won over the former public defender and police and jail abolitionist Nicole Thomas Kennedy to become the new Seattle city attorney. So what can be done to stop the violence, discrimination, and abuse?
We have to be courageous enough to fight back. There's no other way. Malcolm X said it best. When the white man has his flag, we have our flag. When the white man has his army, we have our army. When the white man has his gun, we have our gun. And we just have to be intelligent, organized, create, and build dual and contending power, and last, certainly not least, most of all, make a revolution. And that means overturn this nasty, stinking, foul social system, colonial capitalism, and bring into existence a socialist world under the leadership of the African working class.
The recent city elections illustrate the racist views held by many in law enforcement runs deeper than the police departments and prisons. Racism is a disease that many citizens of the United States possess and therefore do not vote for public officials who intend to reform police departments, and decries the systematic racism and brutality in these areas. Now let's check in with Abbas Montagem to see what he has for us. peace and welcome back to Power to the People. On our last segment of Power to the People, we discussed how the United States is a settler colonial regime. Just to give you all a quick refresher, settler colonialism is when a non-native people, in the case of America, Europeans, came to the indigenous people's lands and set up political, economic, military, and social rule. They established a permanent population, and at the same time they was doing that, they displaced the indigenous people, right? Then at the same time they was doing that, they was enslaving us, African people, right? We must fundamentally understand that settler colonialism is genocidal. It is, point blank period, it is genocidal. On October 22nd, a group called the In Spirit of the Mandela Coalition found the United States guilty of genocide. Guilty of genocide. As African peoples, as indigenous peoples, as brown people, we have understand through ancestral knowledge, through the knowledge passed down through our elders, through being students of the black radical tradition, that our experience on this land called America is genocidal, right? And this tribunal successfully charged the United States guilty with genocide, right? So to begin to understanding genocide, we have to understand the United Nations definition of genocide, right? United Nations, in the present convention, genocide may be any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy in whole or in part amongst national lines, ethnic lines, racial lines, religious groups, right? And some of these components of genocide are one, killing members of a group, two, causing serious bodily harm or mental harm to members of the group, three, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring apart its physical destruction in whole or in part, four, imposing measures intended to prevent the births of a group, and five, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. International jurists throughout the world came to Harlem, right, came to the historic Audubon, in which El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz, also known as Malcolm X, was martyred, and picked up that torch in which Malcolm was calling for the international community to be aware of the human rights condition here in America, right? The jurors picked up the torch, right? The In Spirit of the Mandela Coalition picked up the torch and successfully charged genocide against the United States of America, right? They charged genocide amongst five specific charges. One, the racist police killings of black, brown, and indigenous people. Two, the hyper-incarceration of black, brown, and indigenous people. Three, the political incarceration of civil rights, national liberation era revolutionaries, as well as current day activists. Four, the environmental racism and the impact on black, brown, and indigenous communities, right? Five, public health racism. All of these charges together call for genocide. And that's what it is genocide. And the U.S. was found guilty of genocide, right? If we understand our history, we know that African people have been murdered on this land. Right, through the transatlantic slave trade, it's estimated between 70 to 100 million of our people were murdered. And through slavery, were murdered. Right, and it didn't end there. Through Jim Crow, there was lynchings, murders, right? We understand that the pigs, the police, right, kill us every day, right? The pigs kill us, the pigs incarcerate us, right? We have vigilantes like George Zimmerman murdering our children like Trayvon Martin, right? Emmett Till, beat up, killed, murdered by white supremacists. This is what is genocide, right? The killing of our groups, the killing of the members of our groups, the killing of our new African nation, the killing of our black nation, right? That is genocidal, right? We know that new African youth have been forced into foster care through this racist system of foster care, right? Taking our children from our people, from our house, and taking them otherwhere, right? We know that this has happened and has continued to happen, right? We know that black, brown, and indigenous women have been forcibly sterilized by this racist government, right? And through that, it affects the population from growing, right? We know that today, more black men are under correctional control than were enslaved. We went from the slave plantation all the way to the prison plantation, right? These are genocidal acts that have been committed. And the jurists, right, after hearing hours and hours and hours of testimony over 2 days, found the U.S. guilty of genocide, right? So what does that mean now? Yes, this will be submitted to the United Nations. Yes, lawsuits will be filed, right? But we do not believe that the United Nations in itself will deploy troops.
because we know that the UN has oftentimes been a proxy for American violence. It has not done anything to sanction the United States on the violence that it has committed, not only to black, brown, and indigenous people on this land, but to black, brown, indigenous people throughout the world, right? So it's important that we document this history. We document this genocide. We must say we will never forget the African Holocaust that has occurred, right? The African genocide that has and continues to occur on this land, right? And we must, as people who are struggling against imperialism, colonialism, we must call our position in this land as genocide. Because once we realize that is genocide, right, and once we understand that the U.S. is guilty of genocide, it puts the U.S. up there with the Adolf Hitlers of the world. And if we study Adolf Hitler, we know that Adolf Hitler learned about genocide from the United States of America, right? And it is our human right. We must understand that it is our human right to stop genocide against our people. The United Nations says that. The United Nations doesn't, quote unquote, permit genocide, right? But genocide has been found, and now it is our human right to stop that genocide. So we must embody, as what Jalil Muntakim says, we are our own liberators. We are our own liberators, and we must stop the genocide against black, brown, and indigenous people. We must stop the genocide that the U.S. government commits every single day when it drops bombs in the Middle East, when it tries to steal the oil from Iran. That is genocidal. These sanctions is genocidal, right? So as people who are facing genocide, as Africans, as African people facing genocide, it is our human right to stop this genocide. It is our human right to organize, to fight back, and to stop this genocide. We must embody the slogan, we are only brothers. Power to the people.
Well, that was our show, everyone. I am your host, Daniel Arya, and do join us again next week on another episode of We the People. Bye-bye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters. 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.